If you will please find in your Bible Jeremiah chapter 37. Jeremiah chapter 37.
You know where we left off.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Paul, for that.
I couldn't help it.
Thank you.
I read mine while I sat here early this morning.
Yeah.
I did that for you.
Now, my plan is that we will finish the book of Jeremiah today. You've become part of our class. Thank you. I will tell you, for what it's worth, that we got to where what we're going to start next time is chapter 50. So that is a fairly significant move. And so put on your running shoes and we'll see what happens. Okay. We were in chapter 36, which had to do with some things that happened with King Jehoiakim of Judah. We now move to chapter 37, and we jump forward at least one, maybe two kings. It depends on what translation you read, how far you jump forward. We jump forward to whom?
Zedekiah.
Okay, which king was this? The work of Jeremiah as a prophet is bracketed by two kings. Josiah, the king of reform. It almost worked, but the people didn't stay with it. And Josiah died, and his son took over as king. There were three or four kings after Josiah. The last of those was Zedekiah. So we're now with the last of the kings in this group.
Yep.
Okay?
Quick,
yes, sir.
Question, Harvey. Okay. Have you ever yourself, or do you know where we, serious question.
Never. I deny it all.
Or do you know where we could find kind of a chart that says, here's the kings, and here's all the different kings that come from those kings.
Well, I gave out a chart at the first of this. If you have that one, that's about...
That's all those?
Yeah, it's got dates, and you can... The trouble is they're the same length, but the northern kingdom, Isaiah actually quits between 120 and 150 years before the southern kingdom quits.
I got that.
So if you have that, that's probably the best that you can have. Now, remember that in different translations, the spelling may be a little different. That in any event... Zedekiah is king. And I'm going to ask what sounds like a silly question. What were the circumstances such that he became king? Yeah, that's what you want to make sure you see in this. He is not king because he's the son of a king and the king is dead. Although that's true. Verse 1 tells you primarily he's king because Nebuchadnezzar has made him king. So what kind of a king is he? I want to know what the adjective is. Puppet would be one word. Vassal would be another word. I think there's two or three more, but caretaker king might be used. Vassal or puppet might be better. The power is Nebuchadnezzar's. And what has happened is Nebuchadnezzar has come in with his army, has done some destruction, has carried some people away, and... You can either say he keeps coming and it keeps getting worse, or you can say they keep failing to listen to God's guidance given through Jeremiah, and so Nebuchadnezzar keeps coming back. Take your choice which way. I suspect both are true. In any event, here we are. Verse 2 tells you something fascinating. It's very important that you see this. Mine starts out, neither he nor his courtiers nor the people of the country. What does it say?
Listen
to the word of the Lord. Mine says, paid any attention to the words that the Lord spoke through the prophet Jeremiah. Now notice how it says, the king paid no attention. His officials and advisors, his courtiers, my translation says, paid no attention. And the people in general paid no attention. If you keep track of that little set of three, you'll actually see Jeremiah using that same phrase later. In any event, here we are. Neither the king, nor the courtiers, nor the people of the country paid any attention to the words of the Lord. So verse 3 is shocking. Now, your assignment was to start at chapter 37 and read the rest of Jeremiah. I'm sure you've done that because you all are faithful people who always do the assignments that you're given. Verse 3 is shocking. What happens in verse 3? King sends messengers. It's not a direct contact, but he sends messengers. Two of them are named to Jeremiah. And what's the request?
Priest pray.
Yours says pray. Mine says intercede. I think either term would be good. Intercede is maybe a little more to the point. Intercede for us with the Lord, our God. Isn't that an interesting pronoun? Isn't that an interesting pronoun? They refuse to have anything to do with obeying, listening, or anything else, but they're still claiming a relationship.
They're having a problem, that's right.
Okay, verse 4 tells you something about Jeremiah. What does it say?
He hasn't gone to prison
yet. Yeah, if it says he hasn't gone to prison yet, what can you tell is going to be in his near future? He's going to go to prison. Okay, I just want to make sure you pick that up. At this moment, he has freedom of motion, freedom of movement. Okay. Verse 5 gives you what in our day would probably be a 2-hour special on the news program for NBC, and they contract everything into one sentence. And there is so much packed in that one verse, verse 5. What's the first thing it says?
Pharaoh's army was coming.
Pharaoh's army was on the move from Egypt, mine says, implying from Egypt towards Jerusalem. What's the next thing it says?
Babylon.
Yours says Babylonians. Mine says Chaldeans, because that's the mercenary army that the Babylon forces use. Chaldeans, what else does it say?
Attacking Jerusalem.
Yours says attacking. Mine says besieging. You've got a siege going on. Here comes an army from Egypt, and what do you think if you're the commander of the siege forces? I'm not sure I want to be attacked from my rear. Okay, so what do? Mine says they raised the siege when they heard the news, which yours says is withdraw. Okay, now if you're king of Judah, remember the verses that just came. Intercede with us on behalf with the Lord our God. We're in deep trouble, and Jeremiah was freely moving. He hadn't been put in prison yet. And there had been a siege on Jerusalem, and the siege was lifted because the Pharaoh's army's coming. If you were king of Judah, what would you think? Thank you, Jeremiah. This is great. Praise God. So far, okay? Verse 6. Then the word of the Lord came to the prophet Jeremiah as follows. The Lord God of Israel says this: to the king of Judah, who sent you to consult me, make this reply. Is Pharaoh's army marching to your aid? Now, I don't think yours quite words it that way, but isn't that interesting? Pharaoh's army's coming. Is that good news? Is Pharaoh's army coming to help you? And you keep reading. The Lord is still speaking. That army is going to withdraw to its own country. The Chaldeans will return to attack this city. They will capture it. They will burn it down. The Lord says this: don't cheer yourselves up by thinking the Chaldeans are leaving us for good. They are not leaving. And then verse 10, which I think is the most fascinating. It's not spiritually uplifting or anything. Verse 10 is fascinating in the power of the statement. Even if you were able to cut to pieces the whole of the Chaldean army now fighting against you, until there were nothing left but the wounded, then the wounded would stand up again and they would burn this city down. So, what's the message Jeremiah has just given to the king?
Sorry about that.
Would you care to summarize? There is no hope. You think this looked like a good thing. This whole thing is irrelevant. You don't have a chance.
Didn't do much for his popularity.
Well, that's what I want to get to. Now, you've read this, right? What's the reaction of the king? What's the reaction of the people?
He's a traitor.
And he's on their side.
How dare you give this word? Now, I want to pause for just a minute. I said something the first hour that I want to make sure I've said here. We are in a section which seems terribly repetitious. Do you get that by your reading? It seems terribly repetitious. Why? Because it is. Jeremiah is a prophet for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, however long this period is. And what does he have? He has a consistent message. Listen to the Lord. Make your life with Him. Obey what He says. Follow His ways. Get to know Him. Get to work with Him. And the people ignore all of that and do opposite of what God is saying. They rebel. They turn their backs on God. And Jeremiah says, if you do that, there's going to be destruction come like you can't believe. And it's repetitious because it is. Jeremiah keeps saying, this is what God says. This is what God says. And what happens? People get tired of that. Right? And if you get tired enough of it, what do? What's the cliche?
You
shoot the messenger. Okay?
We have captions now. He's on it.
When you point out the problems, are you a traitor?
No.
The answer is probably not. When you identify areas of concern, are you the problem?
No, but by yelling that you are, it's a distraction away from the problem.
So if someone says everything is great, and if we just say good things, everything will stay great.
Delusion.
That seems to me to be a problem. Is anybody hearing what I'm saying? I'm talking at any level you'd care to pick. When somebody says, quit saying those things, when you say them, they become true. If you don't say them, they won't be true. Shut up. You are seeing this happen with Jeremiah. I'm suggesting to you, that's not the only time it happens. And I'm suggesting to you, when you see it happen, there is a huge problem. And those who say there is no problem at all are putting a Band-Aid on stuff, and that's the way Jeremiah talked about it. You're putting a Band-Aid on an incurable wound. I spent more time saying that in the first hour. I approached it more delicately. Verse 11, the Chaldean army, threatened by Pharaoh's army, had raised the siege of Jerusalem. Now, when you lift a siege, what's the purpose of a siege?
Not at first.
It's to starve them out. Mm-hmm. Eventually, it's to take the city, but the immediate purpose is to stop any transportation of goods in, or persons in or out of the city. So when you lift a siege, what's the first thing probably going to happen? People are going to start to move around. Okay? At the time when the Chaldean army, threatened by Pharaoh's army, had raised the siege of Jerusalem, verse 12, Jeremiah set out from Jerusalem for the territory of Benjamin to see about a piece of his property among the people there. What do you think that was? If you weren't here last week, you won't have any idea what we're talking about. What do you think that is? That's that plot of ground that he bought in Anathoth. Probably. He bought it, remember, in Jerusalem, because he wasn't traveling outside of Jerusalem, but he bought it at a time when nobody in their right minds would be buying land. He bought land because he said, there's a future. There's going to be a day when land will have value again. People will buy and sell, and I'll own this property at that time. Remember that? So he's getting ready to go. He was at the Benjamin Gate, Verse 13, I assume that's the gate that aims towards the property, the territory of the tribe of Benjamin. When the guard commander there, and it names him, arrested Jeremiah, shouting, "You're deserting to the Chaldeans." "It's a lie," Jeremiah answered. "I am not deserting to the Chaldeans." But the guard, the captain of the guard commander, would not listen and took him under arrest to the chief men. Not to the king, but to the chief men. What do the chief men do? Verse 15. Furious with Jeremiah, it says, they had him flogged, one translation said, beaten, most of the translations said, and
imprisoned.
Mine says shut up, imprisoned is a better phrase. In the house of the scribe Jonathan, which had been turned into a prison, Jeremiah found himself in, my translation says, an underground vault. What does yours say?
Dungeon,
that's a better word. And there he stayed for how long?
A long
time. Is that 2 days or six?
Many days.
Yeah. We don't know, but a long time. So far, okay? The messenger just got shot. Is everybody with me?
Quick question.
Yeah.
And I probably missed it someplace, but you keep saying the Chaldeans. In my version said the Babylonians.
The Chaldeans were the mercenary forces that the Babylonians used. It'd be like Hessians in the American Revolution, when the British were fighting. They actually brought in German mercenaries. I believe that's the parallel. So my translation says Chaldeans, but it means the mercenary soldiers under the command of the Babylonians.
Okay.
They've hired their soldiers. Okay. Verse 17. My first word is later. What happens? Zedekiah sends for him. How many times is this that the king has talked to him? This is twice. In this little section anyway, this is the second time. He questioned him privately in the palace. What's his question? Is there any word from the Lord? What's Jeremiah's answer? There is. And he added, "You're going to be handed over to the king of Babylon." I can almost hear, if we had a paraphrased Bible, it could say, "Good luck with that." Jeremiah then said, "What have I done to you or your courtiers or your people?" You hear that echo that I told you you would hear a little bit later? "For you to have me put in prison. Where are the prophets who told you the Babylonians would never attack? I beg you to approve my request. Don't have me taken back to the house of the scribe Jonathan," that's to that dungeon, "or I'm going to die there." And so the king gave an order, and he was released to what? To the court of the guard. Now, if you go back 3 chapters, 4 chapters, 5 chapters, that's where we had him at some earlier time. We've been jumping around in time. So this is, mine says the court of the guard. And he was given a loaf of bread a day from the street of the bakers, as long as there was any bread left in the city. And there he stayed. There's another place that talks about this that says, once he got there, he stayed there right through the fall of Jerusalem. This was where he was all through. So way back, 2 chapters, 4 chapters back, when he was writing those things, he was confined to the court of the guard, so he sent Baruch out to read to the people. This was where that imprisonment came from. Verse chapter 38, verse 1, first word, mine is but. Yours says now. But, and it begins to name some people. They heard the words which Jeremiah was saying to all the people, and then it quotes those words in verses 2 and 3. This is repetition, so I'll let you just review that quickly. Verse 4, the chief men. You sort of think these are the same chief men that were implicit back earlier. These men said to the king, "You got to have this guy put to death. He's unquestionably disheartening the remaining soldiers in the city and all the people too." If he just wasn't saying these things, none of this would be happening. How easy is it to see the problem with that statement? If you just didn't point out the problem, there wouldn't be any problems. In fact, there aren't any problems, so don't bring any up. I'm sorry. There. This man is not seeking the welfare of the people, but their ruin. Is that at all true?
No, he's pointing it out.
He's trying to save what he can. and they won't listen to him. He's in your hands, the king says. Do with him as you wish. The king is powerless to oppose you. So what they do? Yours says a cistern, mine says a storage well. Didn't have any water in it, it says at the end of verse 6. But it did have
mud.
And he sank into the mud. Into the mud, Jeremiah sank, is what mine says. Right? I had a flashback as I was doing this first hour. I didn't say anything about it, but you guys are maybe amenable to this. I delivered newspapers for a while when I was young. Any of you folks ever deliver newspapers? Did you deliver them on a bicycle?
Yes.
With the newspapers and things? Did you ever take a shortcut across a little league field right after a very, very heavy rainstorm? To the point where the mud was pulling your galoshes off your feet. It was caking the inside between the wheel and what do you call the little rain fender between that, to the point where the wheels wouldn't turn, and everywhere you were 3 or 4 inches deep in mud, and you're out in the middle of the thing, and it's just as hard to go back as it is to go forward, and your friends are over on the side laughing at you. You have that experience? He sank in the mud. I have sympathy for that phrase. I have sympathy for that phrase. How'd he get out? Verse 7. How did he get out? This should be shocking to you. Somebody went to the king after hearing and pled his case and got the king to order him out. Who did that?
An Ethiopian eunuch.
Any other Ethiopian eunuch in the Bible?
Where does it say he's eunuch?
Well, I don't know whether your translation says so, but chapter 38, verse 7 is where it says it for mine. Mine actually says Cush, but most of your translations say Ethiopia, and that's right. And mine says
Cushite.
Yeah, that says it.
That's the name of it.
Well, my translation says eunuch. Does yours? Any of yours say?
Yeah, it says eunuch and ethos.
Yeah, there's at least a few verse translations that say that. And I think it's right, although it's a little odd for there to be a eunuch here. That didn't seem to me to be the sort of thing that they did. In any event, he's a foreigner and he's a eunuch, and he takes an action on behalf of Jeremiah. And the only one who does, the only one who does. There is another Ethiopian eunuch in my mind. I imagine that there is some connection, some line you can draw that goes over hundreds and hundreds of years that comes down to this one who was still a seeker 300, 400, 500, 600 years later. In any event, they got him out. How many men did it take to pull him out? Middle of verse 10? Okay. The answer is we don't know, but they had 30 to put to the task. My suspicion is that probably 5 of them pulled him up and 25 of them guarded the place from the chief men who might have tried to stop him. But I don't know how to apportion between those two. My suspicion is they weren't all pulling, but it was probably more than one or two that were pulling. Did you notice that they ended up putting rags down to pad the ropes as they pulled him up? And my sense is that first pull would have been the hard one, because he had sunk into the mud, and that first pull would have been the hard one. And where did he stay? Verse 13. He went back to the court of the guard and stayed there. Okay. Verse 14, what happens?
He's sent for.
By whom? How many times is this?
Three.
This is three. The king says, I want to ask you for a word. Keep nothing back from me. Jeremiah answered him, and his answer is fascinating. If I do provide you what God says, you're going to have me killed for it. And if you don't have me killed for it, you're going to ignore it anyway. The implication is, why bother? The king swore an oath. As the Lord lives, the giver of this life of ours, I will neither have you put to death nor hand it over to those who were determined to kill you. And so Jeremiah said it. And what did he say? He said exactly what he said before. Surrender to the Babylonians or you're going to die. Family's going to die. You won't escape. Verse 19. Who is the king afraid of? He's afraid of the Jewish people who have already gone over to the Chaldeans. Why would Jewish people have gone over to the Chaldeans?
Because
Number one, because they're the power, they're defecting. And that's the word they use in mind. Defect or something like that. Right? Desert. Right? Verse 19. I'm afraid of those who have already gone over the Chaldeans. But what has Jeremiah been saying for the last numpty-dump years? Surrender to the Babylonians or you're going to die. So defect might not be the right word. It might be these are the people who have actually heard Jeremiah and are obeying. And maybe the king's not in any danger from them at all. He imagines himself to be in danger from them. Who does he?
He considers
them to have a danger to him. He's more afraid of them than he is of God himself. And that's the thing I want to make sure you see. He's more afraid of them than he is of God himself. Verse 19. Verse 20, Jeremiah says, you're not going to be handed them over to them. Please listen to the voice of the Lord as I have relayed it to you. And then all will go well with you and your life will be safe. But if you refuse to surrender, and then he begins to talk about the details of what's going to happen, it gets really ugly in there. Verse 24, Zedekiah says to Jeremiah, don't let anyone else hear these words. If somebody comes and asks you, did you talk to the king? What did the king say? What did you say? You just tell him you were trying to get out of the mud pit and get back into a safer place. And that's what Jeremiah did. Chapter 39. In the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the tenth month, Nebuchadnezzar advanced on Jerusalem with his entire army, and they laid siege to it. By my reckoning, that's a new siege. They lifted the first one, they've now put it back. In the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the fourth month, that's about, 18 months later, a breach was made in the city wall. What happens when a breach is made in the city wall? It's all over within a day or two. You're reading about the fall of Jerusalem. This is a almost perfect parallel to 2 Kings 25, and we've already dealt with this. Verse 3, the king of Babylon's officials made their entry, took their seats at the middle gate, and began to take charge of the surrender, the collapse, the destruction. Verse 4, Zedekiah, on seeing them, escaped with all his fighting men, left the city under cover of darkness. How did that go? Verse 5. They got caught. They captured him and took him to Nebuchadnezzar. The prophecy that he would see Nebuchadnezzar face to face took place. And Nebuchadnezzar passed sentence on him. And verse 6 and verse 7 is grisly, awful, and I hardly can imagine it. He had to watch his sons be put to death before his eyes. Slaughtered is the word that's used. He had to watch the leading officials of Jerusalem be put to death before his eyes. And then his own eyes were, in your translation it may say put out, in my translation it says gouged out. The last thing he's allowed to see is the slaughter of his sons. The end of his family. If you just surrender, your family will live. He lived a while, but his family didn't. Verse 9, the commander of the guard deported the remainder of the population left in the city, the deserters who had gone over to him, and the rest of the artisans, the folks who had some value. What happened at the end of World War II? You remember?
We got the scientists
and the Russians got the ones we couldn't get. And Wernher von Braun, who had made V-1 and V-2 rockets to rain on London, ended up in charge of the American space program. Fascinating how some of these things work. So everybody was deported, right? Verse 10 says no. What happens?
That's some of the worst people there.
The poor people who represented no threat of any kind were left behind. Verse 11, and what does it say? With regard to Jeremiah, Nebuchadnezzar had given an order to the commander of the guard. Take him, look after him, do him no harm, but treat him as he may ask you. And it talks about that person then doing what he said. You actually don't see that happen until chapter 40, verse 1. Jeremiah was found in chains with all the other captives from Jerusalem and Judah being deported to Babylon. And the commander of the guard spotted him and pulled him out of line, took his chains off, and basically said to him, "The king has given you protection. You can go wherever you want. You can go with me to Babylon. I'll look after you. You can stay here with the poor people. You can go wherever you want. The whole of the world is open to you." What would you have felt like if you and you alone were spared? He's called the weeping prophet for a reason. Or, verse 5, chapter 40, you can even go back with those poor people. "I've left the grandson of Shaphan in charge." Remember Shaphan from Josiah's reign? One of the ones who led in that big reform that almost worked. His grandson's going to be the governor. If you keep reading, the governor gets assassinated. The assassins get killed. The remnant that's left says the only hope we have is to go to Egypt. And so off to Egypt they go. Just before they go, they say, "Would you consult the Lord on our part?" to Jeremiah. Jeremiah basically says, "Why bother?" And the people swear, "Whatever God says, whether we like it or not, we'll do it." That's chapter 42, verse 6. "Whether we like it or not, we will obey the voice of the Lord our God to whom we are sending you, so that we may prosper by obeying the voice of the Lord." How long did it take for the word to come back? Verse 7? 10 days. Guess what the word of the Lord said? "Don't go to Egypt. Stay where you are." What did the people say? Verse 2 of chapter 43. Middle of verse 2. Jeremiah says, "I got the word from the Lord. He says, stay here. Don't go to Egypt." Middle of verse 2 of chapter 43. What did the people say?
"You're telling a lie."
"You liar. I'm sure God was going to tell us to go to Egypt."
"The Lord our God did not send you to say."
And so off they go, dragging Jeremiah with them. And Baruch as well. When he gets to Egypt, he digs a big hole in the city that he's in, puts some rocks inside, covers them all up, and tells the people, "When Nebuchadnezzar comes and destroys Egypt and all of you with it, he's going to put his throne right here for the judgment day." And all that happens. Now, we're running low on time. We've got about 5 minutes to do something that we did in more like 12 minutes, maybe 10 minutes in the first hour, but we're going to do it anyway. Okay. Chapter 45, how many verses?
Five.
And they're all pointed at God giving Baruch a sense of protection. But if you look carefully, it's not a very good way of saying it. God is taking Baruch to task. Verse 5, "You're asking for special treatment. Don't you ask that. Disaster is coming on all humanity. I am going to allow you to escape with your life wherever you want to go." But it seems like Baruch doesn't quite get the positive affirmation that Jeremiah's got. Chapter 46 starts a whole bunch of prophecies against nations that are around them. So what I want to do now, I'm going to just show you how I'm doing this. I want to look at the first verse or two so that we know who the prophecy is about. Chapter 46, who's the prophecy about?
Egypt.
Yeah, verse 1 says nation. That's the introduction to the next 20 chapters or the next 10 chapters, whatever. But verse 2 says, this is the first one that's going to be on Egypt. And it basically says Egypt is going to be destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. They're going to be a desert and all this sort of stuff. Yes, yes, yes. But if you will, please jump down to verse 25. Jump down to verse 25. What does it say? "The Lord of Heaven's army, the God of Israel, says, I'm going to punish the gods of Thebes and all the other gods of Egypt. I'll punish its rulers and Pharaoh too, and all who trust in them. I'll hand them over to those who want them killed, to King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon and his army." And then the word "but." What does it say?
It's going to go back to where it was before.
"But afterwards, the land will recover." Mine says from the ravages of... Yours says that too, from the ravages of war. What's the message to Egypt? You're going to get punished and punished severely. But when it's all over, you will still survive. Egypt is still a nation identifiable today with a legacy and a heritage that goes back. The British tried to take control and all that. Others have tried to take control. But there's a legacy for Egypt that goes right through. So far, okay? chapter 47. Who's it for? For the Philistines. Living where?
Gaza.
In Gaza. Okay. Would you go to verse 7? This is the end of that. So, does it say, but I will bring you back and restore you after all this is over? What does it say? Quickly. What does it say?
Cities will be destroyed.
You're going to be destroyed, and that's the last word. First, chapter 48. First, who's it talking about?
Moab.
Moab. Talks about Moab. If you go in chapter 48, way down to verse 27, all this, you just have, if you've already read it, you know, the predictions, the prophecies that are being made are awful. Verse 27 tells you why. What was Moab's crime? They ridiculed Israel when Israel was in trouble and they were cousins. Verse 29, what's their second problem? What's the word that gets repeated and repeated? Pride, 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 arrogance, and a haughty heart. So what do you expect to see at the end? Jump to 47 and let's see. What does it say?
Terror.
Verse 47. Moab's going to make it through. Now that's what I want you to see. You're going back and forth on these prophecies. They are all dire and terrible. But at the end of some of them is hope. And at the end of others is not hope. I'm ready for 49. Who is this to? Ammonites or Ammon. And look at the tail end of that first verse. They're the ones who worship Moloch. Remember what Moloch was? That's an idol that has a big space in the middle that's heated up to burning heat, and then you throw babies in there and kill the babies as worship to God. Fires of Moloch, they're called at some place. Verse 6, what do you see? It's a little surprising. We're skipping the prophecies in between, but you're supposed to have read that already. Verse 7, who's it for?
Edom.
If you come down to verse 10, I'm going to strip bare the land of Edom, God says. There will be no place left to hide. Children, brothers, and neighbors will all be destroyed, and Edom itself will be no more. Verse 12, this is what the Lord said. If the innocent have to suffer, how much more are you going to have to suffer? You will not go unpunished. You must, very interesting figure, it comes from the end of Jesus' life, you must drink this cup of judgment. Okay? What's the judgment for Edom? Verse 21.
Quakes, screams.
The earth will shake with the noise of Edom's fall. Its cry of despair will be heard all the way to the Red Sea. No sense there of restoration. Verse 23, who's it about? We're almost done. Damascus. Okay, verse 27, what happens to Damascus? Fire and everything is going to take them out. Now, Damascus as a city came back, but not apparently with this people group as part of it. At least that's the implication I read. Verse 28, who's this about? These are kingdoms, we don't know their names very well. Kedar and Hazor, mine says. Okay. Verse 33, what's the judgment? Nothing but jackals, desolate forever. No one will live there. No one inhabit it. Verse 34, we are almost done.
Elam.
This is another cousin group. Verse 39. What's after all the destruction, after all the horror, what happens? They're restored. Chapter 50, who's it for?
Babylon.
And there ain't time to do that because that's several chapters worth, and that's where we'll start next time. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we're reading things that seem so grisly and so hard. But we realize that something is shining through this. What we're noticing is that you send your word, and people don't want to listen. They don't want to listen, And they don't want the people who have your word to have any chance of speaking. So I pray today for those of your children whose ears may be stopped. We need to all talk with one another. We need to be open to the concerns of each other. We need not to say, don't speak. Say good things and good things will be true. We need to face problems, and those who identify the problems are not our enemies. I pray for this place. I pray for our nation, and I pray for our world, because it seems like everywhere we look, this problem exists. And I pray all this in the precious name of your Son, Jesus. Amen. What's your assignment?
Read it.
Read the rest of this, starting at chapter 50.